Hello and welcome to the Inspiring Women Interviews with Amanda Alexander. Interviews are with female leaders who are passionate about helping all women to achieve success. Together, we can change the world. You can find out more about Amanda at amandaalexander.com. Enjoy the show. Hi, this is Amanda Alexander, and you're very welcome to the Inspiring Women Interviews podcast. Interviews are with female leaders and female role models who advocate helping all women to achieve success. And today I am really delighted to be interviewing Jacqueline de Rojas. Jacqueline is VP at Citrix. She's also non-executive director of Argos and Homebase and HRD. She's president of Tech UK. Jacqueline is a believer in smart partnering and in technology that makes life easier. Really importantly for today's interview, Jacqueline is a fantastic champion for women and diversity, particularly in technology. In one of her first management roles, Jacqueline was told that the company she worked for, now get this, didn't put women on the leadership team. I'll be asking Jacqueline about that in just a moment. Today, however, Jacqueline is a leading digital executive and she's a firm advocate of the importance of boardroom equality for successful businesses. She dedicates a lot of her time to encouraging and empowering young women to enter and to stay and to lead from the front in the technology sector, whether that's in the boardroom or in technical roles. She is an international executive at the mobile workspaces company Citrix. And she's been employed throughout her career by global blue chip software companies to accelerate growth by pulling fantastic teams together who can operate under pressure and extend their reach through smart partnerships. She holds a number of board and advisory positions. She serves as non-executive director on the board of Home Retail Group PLC, focusing on the digital agenda. She's also a board advisor at Digital Leaders, and she lends her support to the technology group of the 30% Club to encourage more women on boards. Away from her day-to-day role at Citrix, Jacqueline is the president of Tech UK, and her presidency at Tech UK focuses on the ambition for the UK to really grab its position as a digital nation of significance. She believes that to achieve this, all geographies and demographics across the UK must be included, and we have to strive to equip our country with the very best infrastructure and supportive business legislation possible. Jacqueline believes that ultimately nothing can be achieved unless the UK tech industry attracts and retains talent from right across the diversity spectrum. And as if all that wasn't enough, this year, Jacqueline was named Computer Weekly's most influential woman in UK IT. So, Jacqueline, wow. I would love to start asking you about that time when that company said to you, we don't put women on the leadership team. So, welcome. Thank you for being here today. Tell us about it.
Thank you very much, Amanda. Delighted to be here. And yes, it has been a bit of a journey, my career, in a good way. So about the time when I was told, I went for a promotion, and it was a promotion for a country manager position, and I was running a very big team, hundreds of people, and hundreds of thousands of dollars, actually millions, hundred millions of dollars. And I was up against a male counterpart who was running a region which was significantly smaller. I'm going to say 20 times smaller. And I thought, okay, this is mine to lose. But actually, when I got to the point of decision, I was told, we don't have women on the leadership team. And, you know, I heard that and I thought, okay, well, I'm out. But it wasn't a petulant out. It was a, you know, I've got to look for the miracle here. I've always been a big believer in, you know, when something bad happens, and to me that was pretty devastating because I'd worked a long time to become the person that I'd already become at that point. Not to get the top job was crushing. However, you know, I guess the miracle was that at least they told me that I was never going to make it there. And so it gave me an opportunity to reframe it as a learning experience and go and find a new opportunity somewhere else, which I did very successfully. So I'm grateful for that. I have to say, looking back over my shoulder, the person they did choose did not last very long. Some years later, many years later, I went back in a very big leadership position because they came looking for me. So there was some poetic justice in that. I'm not mad about it. I think we will all, as women in a male-dominated industry, have inflection points where there's a fork in the road and we have a decision to make. And I would say walk tall. Don't let your head go down, because there is definitely opportunity out there if you can see it.
Thank you. I love your expression, look for the miracle. And when we've talked before, I think that's something that you've said that served you throughout your life, look for the miracle, isn't it?
It is. And I have a very funny story, because I have a very beautiful 23-year-old daughter who is actually not in technology. She's in musical theatre, very confident. And we only had one rule when she was growing up, which was, you may not have a tattoo. And of course, with my NLP training now, I should have known that I was programming her to have a tattoo, of course. So she went on her first holiday abroad, and she came back and she said, Mum, I got some good news and some bad news. And I said, okay, give me the bad news. And she said simply, I've broken the rule. And I said, oh gosh, right, okay, well, where is it? I thought it's going to be in her forehead or, you know, awful, where she couldn't hide it if she needed a serious job. But actually, she had it on her foot, the side of her foot, in beautiful italics. And she said, the good news is that it's something that you taught me and something that I hold very dear and I live my life by. And she's had inscribed on her foot, look for the miracle. So I am delighted to have passed it on, but be careful what you wish for, and be careful how you're programming your children, because they do exactly what you tell them to do.
What good programming. I think I could accept that tattoo on the side of the foot for look for the miracle on it.
Exactly.
How did you start your career? You've talked about what happened when you came up against that attitude of we don't employ women at senior management level. So you went elsewhere, but that was obviously some way into your career when you were going for promotion. How did you start?
Yes. So I did a business European business degree in Germany. And I did it in German, so the thesis was written in German, and we had to learn French at the same time. I'd done A-level French and German at the time, so I was fairly able to communicate, but found myself there, and then finished my degree and came back to London and realised that I needed to earn some money. Of course, my ambition, my dream, had always been to do something and I'd always thought I would be reading the news on the BBC at 6 o'clock, doing something dramatic like declaring peace or maybe even war these days. But that wasn't to be. And I was offered a role as a technology recruiter, so recruiting talent into the tech industry. And after about 2 years of that, I decided that selling a product that talked was quite complicated. And I went to work for my best client, which was a company called Sign-On. And I worked for them, and that was my entree into software, and I have been in the industry ever since. So a software executive in a company selling AS400 computer-aided software engineering. So a complete different outcome to the BBC newscaster I had huge ambitions to be.
So you've been in technology for how many years now?
27 and a half.
And when you started your career, where you kind of arrived in technology unexpectedly 27 years ago, did you create goals and did you have anything in mind, like, yes, by 2015, I want to be voted most influential woman in IT and, you know, be VP of Citrix. Obviously not so specific. Did you have big goals, big dreams, big ambitions?
You know, the tech industry has moved at such a pace that it's hard to set goals that far out. You know, 3 years in this industry is a long, long time, and the landscape changes all the time. Mm-hmm. And I have been so excited and blessed to be in an industry that has had such changing horizons, opportunities, and has created massive ambition in me, but almost without the need to set huge goals, because there are always crushing timelines. There's always innovation which says we're going to try something extraordinary next, or we're going to, you know, create impact for people that has huge business change implications. And so I haven't had to create enormous goals. But what I have done is looked at my values inside what I want and how I want to achieve what I achieve. And I've looked at the things that have been important to me as I've moved through my journey. So, you know, looking after my family whilst holding, you know, a very frenetic job schedule has been, you know, something I've had to really work hard at. I think having a personal life and trying to achieve work-life balance is also fairly complicated in a job as demanding as any of the ones I've ever had. And I think part of that is because being in a male-dominated technology world, I felt the need. I don't know if everyone else feels the need, but I have heard it said, you know, I have felt the need to prove myself much, much more than my male colleagues. And I'm not sure if that's my innate fear of failure, which is my biggest driver. But I really felt that pushing myself harder than my colleague, proving to myself actually, and perhaps to my family, that I was worthy, even though I'd followed a path which was perhaps not so expected. I think, you know, people expect their children to be doctors, nurses, teachers, whatever. I'm not sure technology exec was in the list of things that my parents expected of me. I think it was there was a big proving journey for me, and I think the goals and ambition piece came from a different direction, not from the ones that the business would set for me, but ones that I would set for myself, and mostly personal.
So proving yourself and pushing yourself has always been the driver rather than anything external.
It has, and I think that's because I came from a very humble background. You know, I was in a broken family where my mother left her Chinese husband, I'm half Chinese, when I was 8, and I acquired a new stepfather who I didn't particularly like at the time. I think it's always tricky to come into that world of happy families, in inverted commas, and trying to make that work. And I remember at the age of O-levels, GCSEs today, I had my letter with my results in, and my stepfather is a very, I'm going to say, very humble man from Yorkshire. He definitely didn't have huge ambition, ex-army as well. And he asked me what was in the envelope, and I said, it's my O-level results. And he said, well, what's in there? And I said, I don't know. So he opened the envelope for me, and I got rather good results, lots of A's. And he said the words, what are you trying to do? Show me up. And, you know, I wasn't really sure as a 16-year-old what I was supposed to do with that. And, you know, in my later years, I wonder whether he was being sarcastically humorous, which actually would fit with his personality. At the time, I didn't take it like that. I thought, you know, I'm actually going to have to figure out whether I want to have no ambition like him, or whether I was going to take a different path and say, I'll show you how amazing I could be. And actually, I thank him for that opportunity and reframed it as, you know, a moment where I could definitely see my path changed dramatically, my ambition and energy changed enormously in terms of what I decided I was going to achieve. And I think, you know, again, it was an inflection point where I made a decision to definitely become a different person and change the direction of my life. And I talked to him about it subsequently, and he can't remember that moment. And I think he's probably being, you know, funnily sarcastic. But I think, you know, hormonal teenagers take it differently. And it's quite shocking as a parent, you know, to have that fed back. I think he was shocked that I'd taken it that way. And I now, you know, think, gosh, we've got to be very careful as guardians of the children that we look after. You know, what we say resonates very differently with sometimes how they receive it. And that's true of people that we work with as well. So it's a good learning point. And I am grateful for it, but it definitely coloured my journey in a good way.
Yeah, and it's interesting that it coloured your journey in a good way, because it's the kind of offhand comment, and as you say, your stepfather couldn't remember saying it, that could be responsible for a whole heap of self-limiting beliefs.
Oh my gosh, yeah, I've got plenty of those, by the way. You know, it did make me feel, right, okay, what can I do with this? And, you know, sometimes life is about an attitude and approach, isn't it? And I think we can either look at the industry that we're in as a, or the family that we're in as a, gosh, my lot is not so great. Or we can look at it and think, okay, where's the opportunity in here? Where's the miracle? And that's how I chose it to be. And for me, it has definitely enabled me to achieve bigger and better things. And it, at the very least, it made me feel better about things that could have been quite dark.
Yes. Yes, the attitude or approach really rings true. There's a quote by Albert Einstein, and I came across it again just yesterday. I wish I had it in front of me. And he says, whether you see the, and I'm misquoting here, whether you see the world as, I can't remember whether it's a safe place or a dangerous place, colours your whole life, is the most important thing about how your life will be, which reflects your philosophy about looking for the miracle.
Yes, definitely.
Jacqueline, you said before that rather than goals, you looked at your values, and my spidey senses went, oh, values, a woman after my own heart, because I believe very much in helping people to really look at their values, and I believe that our goals, our intentions flow from those once we get clear about our values. So I'm really interested to know more about that and know how you reconciled having a family, looking after your family, and having that work-life balance, personal life, with the other Jacqueline who needed to push herself and prove herself and have this innate fear of failure within a male-dominated world. Big question, but essentially, how did the values help with that?
Enormously. I don't know how I could have got through without them, actually, because I looked at what I was about, who I was, and what I stand for. And I had a Catholic upbringing, so there's a lot of self-reflection when you are asked to go to Mass a lot or church a lot. And I'm not a religious person, actually, but I think I have something spiritual in me where I like to feel very centered. We talked before about yoga and meditation, and they're very close to my heart too. But on the point of reflection and what my values are, I've got three. One is integrity, and that has served me well throughout my entire journey, both family and work. And I think without that, I lose my moral compass and I'm dead, I feel. So if there's ever a difficult decision to make, then integrity is always a big guiding star for me. So that's important. And that served me well both in business and at home. So transparency, hugely important. The second one is family, and family for me is family at home, but also my extended family, which is my team at work, or my community. And I live in an amazing village called Taplow, where we have a very, very strong community spirit, and I love that, need that, and I celebrate within all of those communities. And then the third one is, which I feel extremely strongly about, and that's generosity. And I think, you know, people have been extremely generous to me on my journey. And I think that in technology, and especially for women in technology, for us who have been lucky enough to get to a position of influence, then, you know, sending the elevator back down is really important. Or just look over your shoulder and see who you could, you know, reach out to and help just a little bit on their journey, or even just give them a word of encouragement, or, you know, offer them a connection that you can make to someone who could help them. All of those things make an enormous difference to somebody else and might cost you nothing at all. And I would just urge people, women and men in our business, to think about who they could help and who they could acknowledge. We have a little thing inside my own leadership team at Citrix where they are asked to acknowledge at least one person a day. And it's a nice, generous thing to do. And I believe that it's good karma. If you put it out there, then you'll get it back as well. And that's why, you know, winning that award, the most influential woman in IT, in UK IT, was really exciting, because it gave me an opportunity to have a platform where I could share those values, and I could offer, you know, offer to shine a light on the issues of women in tech. We only have 16% of women in tech in the UK, and we need to do better at that. We could have more profitable businesses with more women in technology, that's proven. And we could have a larger talent pool, which we definitely need.
Oh, do you know, so many questions and nodding here from me as you've been talking. I love that metaphor of sending the elevator back down. I think I'll nick that for the podcast show, actually, because it says it in such elegant language, which is what I'm doing here, which is interviewing people like you who want to see all women succeed. Thank you for that. Thank you for that. I'm with you on that. I believe that serving other people, and serving other people from a place of love, and as to use your value through generosity, does come back. I believe it can be used as a marketing technique, you know, not in a cynical way, but simply by just saying, right, I'm just going to focus on helping other people, and it will come back.
Yeah.
I'd like to hone in on the 16% of women in technology. Where does that figure come from?
Yeah, so there are lots of studies. And most of, well, actually, it's probably an average of a number of different studies, and you can look at it whichever way you like. There are, for example, studies which say there are 23% of women in boardroom positions now. That's from, I think, the Davis report called for more women in the boardroom. But if you look further down in the ranks, we do rather poorly in middle management. We have quite a lot of women in lower paid and lower classed roles. We just don't have them at the top in the leadership positions or the middle management positions. And that's where we really need to focus. And we need to focus in a way that isn't just tokenism. We also need to make sure that we've got strong commitments to succession planning, so that we have women to fill women's shoes, if you will, when they move on as well. We're a very fast-moving technology industry, so people do move around, and that's right, but we need to keep women in a succession plan at the top table, because let's face it, inclusion is definitely about being in the room, but diversity is really only achieved when you're at the table. And that's why I think it's really important to have leadership positions and women filling those, because they also define rules in businesses. Like, for example, I'm very lucky to have a great HR team, a human resources team here at Citrix, where, you know, we can do things like we can change job descriptions for engineers, and we can change that to problem solving, as an example. So there are little things that can be done by men or by women, but to encourage more women into the tech sector. And I think if we have more women leaders, we're more likely to beget more women down in the industry, because we tend to recruit in our own image. And that's important to us if we're going to make a difference to those numbers.
Having the role models there for women to see that they can aspire to.
Good point about role models. We need role models at the top. And I, of course, am the 27-and-a-half-year-old veteran in this industry with grey hair. However, we do need cool young women in the industry to attract other cool young women into the industry. And I'd like to see more of that, more of those role models too.
Where do you think we are going wrong? Because I know that the technology industry has been losing women for many, many years, and there have been so many initiatives to try to address that. It seems that we still haven't got it right. I was one of those women who, you know, dropped out years ago.
I think right. It's tricky. We have an affordability issue for sure. I think women and childcare, women in the tech industry or women in industry in general, and the affordability of childcare, it's a question. How do we do that? And I think we need to keep asking that question and figure out how we ensure that childcare is both the domain of women and of men. And I think, you know, because women's issues are also for men to solve, and perhaps we also need to include a lot more men in the debate. We do sometimes, but I find that I operate and work in a male-dominated environment, but then I go and talk about women's issues mostly in a female-dominated environment. So I think we probably need to switch that balance on the conversation. I see that happening, by the way, in some places. So we need to almost have a bring a bloke initiative when we talk about women and women's issues. And then I think there is the how do we encourage young girls and women to make technology decisions about their education choices when they're at school. And that's, there are lots of organisations doing lots of great work. As president of Tech UK, we find lots of organisations and we try and join the dots on those organisations so that we can amplify that message. I go into schools and I talk to young girls. I think, though, going back to our earlier conversation, they probably want to see cool role models who have made it at age, you know, 24, which is much more, they see that's much more within their grasp rather than the, you know, 27-year journey that I've made. Mm. That probably seems a bit too far out.
Mm. So perhaps we need not just role models like you, but role models who are perhaps just a couple of steps ahead.
Yeah, I think so. And also, you know, we glamorize in films and TV, we glamorize a lot of young men. I think maybe we need to think about some technology-based role models in some cool movies and TV programs. I think Lisa Simpson is about as cool as it gets right now on The Simpsons.
And she's cool at playing the saxophone, isn't she?
And there's nothing wrong with that. You know, I do think we can up our game in that area. You know, our ambition is to create the most successful football team on the planet, we'd be scouting for talent at age 8. And we'd have league tables to shine a light on the talent that rose to the top, and then we'd be selling them for, you know, millions of pounds as they transfer across football clubs. That's what we would do. That's what we do. Mm. If we then said, okay, we are going to create a digital nation of significance, what's the plan? Because at the moment, the plan is, oh, let's wait until they turn out of university at age whatever, or, you know, we stumble across them as we go into a recruiting mode. But, you know, we don't have anything where we really are highly organized in terms of catching, creating, retaining, nurturing top talent in tech. And I would say that there's lots of pinpricks of ecstasy, so there are lots of people doing some really great things. Mm. And we need to amplify and organize ourselves as we would if we were creating an outstanding, you know, world-class football team.
And to amplify ourselves, just bringing back that from what you said before into what you've just been talking about doing this early and getting organized, bring a bloke, getting men talking about, in inverted commas, women's issues as well. Is there something we need to change to do that? Because quite often I think men feel it's not their place, or they feel threatened, and they often feel that it's well, we're going to go down the positive discrimination route, and I've got no chance, and this is all just about, you know, promoting women, to take a typical kind of bloke response.
Yeah, and you know what, I totally understand why that reaction is there. I personally am against quotas. I personally believe you absolutely need to recruit the best person for the role with the best skills and the best cultural fit, for sure. I would never go against any of those values. On the other hand, should we have balanced shortlists for, you know, talent that we're reviewing when we make those decisions? I think we need to work a bit harder at getting those, you know, more diverse talent lists together, which are inclusive, rather than let's go for proximity hiring or people that we know. And that's where I think we can make a real difference. Now, does that mean that the talent pool is a problem? Yes, it does. We still have an extremely small pool of talent. But I believe women are out there. I think we need to find them. I think we need to encourage employers to change the way that they write job descriptions. I also think that we as employers can do more in our cultural shift to make it easier for working women with families to engage in the workforce. And to me, that is all about flexible working. Mm-hmm. I truly believe that work is not a place, it's where you are. I read, you know, only this week in the news that we've got, you know, people travelling into London for two and a half hours each way because housing is so expensive. Well, I think there's a balance between, is it really an issue with housing and housing prices, or is it that employers have a culture of needing to see bums on seats before they feel you're being productive? And I think we need to just create a balance where flexible working is an accepted practice, mm-hmm. and that remote working means that we can include people who have access to broadband but live, you know, in the middle of nowhere. And that means that the talent pool is instantly enlarged, or it could mean that we are also including disabled people in the talent pool. And it could mean that we're including working parents in the talent pool who couldn't afford that travel time before. So I think flexible working and a cultural shift in employment practices is also really important in this debate.
Yes, I do. And it's about focusing in on people rather than one specific type of people, is what you're saying.
Exactly.
We're all people together. You said that, just going back to not being in favour of quotas, and it's about, however, getting balanced talent lists. And I think you were talking about writing job descriptions and tweaking the way that they're written, that kind of thing. So is getting the balanced talent list about getting the higher percentage of people in that list in the first place, so there is more chance of having the balanced candidates come out at the other end?
Yes, I think it is. I think also part of what I've been doing over a number of years is to get my network of fabulous women in front of headhunters, because headhunters, and speed date them into each other, because headhunters know who they know, which I know is an obvious thing to say, but there is a small group of execs, and we all get offered the same jobs and or interviews for the same jobs and tapped up for this or for that, but there is also an enormous layer of talent which is coming through and which is invisible unless we make the introductions. And this comes back to generosity, which is that people in positions where they have influence and are connected to headhunters, you know, if we opened up our contacts to the headhunters, they would find amazing people and be able to get the next generation of talent into executive positions, and that way we can all make a difference at grassroots level. Some of this doesn't have to be big bang planet shaking stuff, but by everybody opening up their contact lists in a responsible way, then I think the recruiters firstly would be opened up to a whole new world of possibility and opportunity with people that they hadn't met before.
So the layers of talent that you're talking about, is that generally the middle management layer of talent who don't necessarily have the connections with the headhunters?
It could be middle management. It could be just people who've been working so hard in the jobs that they're doing that networking is kind of number 3, 4, or even 10 on their list.
Yes.
And they're just not connected in. Mm. And so it's for me sometimes to say, you know, I really think that you should meet so and so, and or even just make the connection on LinkedIn. I think this will be a good connection. And you would be amazed how many times that I do that people say, wow, gosh, I didn't know that person existed. And they have got big jobs on the back of it. And in technology, it is not unusual for people to be so busy that networking is at the bottom of their list.
Oh, yes. Yeah, not just in technology. This is a conversation I have with a lot of my clients when they're talking about changing jobs, is literally not having the time to network. LinkedIn is a great resource now, because it doesn't necessarily mean that we have to turn up at a networking event.
Yes, exactly. And I love it because it makes life so easy and, you know, transparent. And I think those connections, again, it costs nothing, but it is a nice, generous act of, you know, that role isn't good for me. And it's very easy to shut down the conversation at that point. But you could then just add one little sentence, but have you thought of X, Y, and Z? And that makes a big difference to the outcome of their journey or career inside the business.
So Jacqueline, the people that you might help through your value of generosity, if you were to give them some advice on how they could initiate that process of seeking support from people like you, I guess there's a courage piece here about being courageous and asking. A lot of people are very concerned, particularly women, really bad at asking for help. What advice would you give them?
Well, if I see that, I sometimes just send them a LinkedIn reference.
Yeah.
Because it's interesting how confidence boosting that can be. I also think there is, often when I say to someone, have you thought about this kind of role? They would say the words, I don't think I'm good enough for that kind of, which I think is always interesting. So just having a 5-minute conversation about, are you kidding me? Do you know? Let me tell you what I see. And if you take the time to reflect back, you know, the amazing things that they've already achieved, and you mirror the career that they've had, or the things that they've achieved, I think it's actually sometimes quite shocking. But it, again, it goes back to just take 10 minutes just to give someone a little nudge in the right direction. You'd be amazed about the outcome of where self-worth can get to. I mean, I know, because my self-worth has always been pretty rock bottom in terms of, no, I'm not worthy, I can't do that. Why would you think I can do that? I even remember having my first managing director's role and thought, oh God, I've got the role now. What on earth does a managing director do? And of course, you know, you have all of that self-doubt. And I think just being there, and sometimes fielding a call from people when they need someone to talk to that isn't their direct line manager, but just gives them a little bit of confidence boosting, then, you know, I think those things make a big difference. Just look at what you've achieved, list out what you've done, and then reflect it back, or have someone, you know, ask them what they see when they look at you. Not in an arrogant way, but just, who do they see? And I think you'd be amazed at the reflected opportunity that people can see in you, and how that can boost your confidence.
Yes, hear, hear. That mirror is just, it makes such a difference. As you say, it just needs to be the 5-minute conversation that, as you say, are you kidding? Look at this. This is what I see. Oh, yeah. I never thought about it that way.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it's also important, you know, managing managers upwards. So, I spend a lot of time with senior people, or even people I report to, and I always make sure that I acknowledge what a great job they've done. And I think it's interesting, the higher up you go, the less you hear it. Mm. And so it's really important to also make sure that you've got that acknowledgement going on at senior levels, because that's where, you know, confidence can sometimes get lost. It's a lonely place at the top for all of us.
You mentioned acknowledgement before as well, and you said that in Citrix you have something where people do an acknowledgement once a day. How does that, do you kind of all sort of do it in front of each other, or is it just a habit that's ingrained?
No, and it's not monitored. It's an invitation, actually, to think about your people and retention, and what's top of mind when people say, this is what I like about working with you and at Citrix. And it's about, you know, having interesting things to do and feeling acknowledged. Money's kind of number 5. It's not number 1. So part of creating that family culture is about how, you know, are you acknowledging people in your team? And that, literally, it's an invitation from me to my direct reports to say, you know, who have you acknowledged today? Mm. And, you know, sometimes I had an email back yesterday saying, oh, this is what I did, just so you know. And they just wanted to share it because they felt really good in terms of what they got back from it. So, you know, I think it's really interesting. I had another one where someone had been here for 10 years and we, you know, celebrated that. And then there was this whole acknowledgement thing going on email, which is lovely. And it makes a difference to someone's day. It colours your journey in a really good way if you have had that acknowledgement. And believe you me, I think it makes such a difference in confidence and also why people want to work with you.
Yes, it does. It makes such a difference. What about acknowledgement and acknowledgement of yourself and self-promotion? I even hesitate to use the word self-promotion because the connotations are so negative, but I think it's so important. What do you think?
So I've reframed that because I'm rubbish at acknowledgement of myself. you know, I'm really, really not very good at receiving that. I'm also the person that doesn't particularly like getting Christmas presents, but I've actually created a way of receiving them in quite a gracious way. But I find it painful on the basis that I think I'm not very deserving, and I'd much rather give than get. And I imagine that might be something fairly common amongst women. On the self-promotion side, I've reframed it, which is, okay, what can I use this for? What will this platform give me? So, you know, when I am acknowledged for anything or given a platform to speak like a, you know, the Computer Weekly Influential Woman in IT this year. I've used that as a platform to shine a light on women's issues, how we can get more diversity across the business, why it's a good thing, how much difference can we make to getting more women into tech and creating that enthusiasm for diversity. So I think for me, by reframing self-promotion as a platform for influence and making a difference, I reconciled myself to that in a way that's okay for me.
So it's a really positive flip of serving other people, of using that to again come back to giving back and living through your value of generosity.
And absolutely. How can we find a way to shorten the time to success for other women? Because some of our journeys have been so tortuous and so ridiculously backward in terms of, you know, unthoughtful leadership, that, you know, there has to be a way in which women can challenge in a good way, without leaving too many dead bodies around them, I think. Mm-hmm. But also by figuring out what is the shortest route to success and how do you maintain that? How do you take everyone with you? And I really believe that that's a very interesting way to not just go on the same journey, but to find a more efficient way to get there faster.
Mm. Mm. You used a phrase just before, unhelpful leadership, and it just sparked a thought in my mind. I'd just like to ask you something, because this comes up a lot for my clients, and because I've just had a conversation this morning with somebody, and I hear so many stories of women dealing with so-called unhelpful leadership, I think it would be really useful to get your take on this. If a woman is ambitious about her career and she loves what she's doing, but she is in a position where she feels that she's in, and I'll use the example of from the conversation I had earlier this morning, perhaps a toxic work culture or with a toxic colleagues, and she feels stuck because she has got the one part of the equation right with the flexible working where she is, and she feels that if she looks elsewhere, she will say goodbye to the flexible working she's built up through loyalty through her current company. But things are getting to such a point, such a burning point, that it's having an impact on her health in the current working environment. And I ask this because it comes up so often, that I can't leave because, you know, these hygiene factors are ticked here. However, this is just horrible. How would you help someone like that?
Yeah, well, I don't have the solution to everything, but I tell you what I would do. I think that I would decide what was most important to me. Mm. And I think there's two sides to it. One is perception, one is reality. And that is that I never do anything that I don't want to do. It might be uncomfortable, but I don't tend to operate in an environment that I would consider to be toxic. Now, having said that, this one's quite tricky, because if you are a person that looks for tricky things, and I'm going to use an analogy. If I said to you, just look around the room and look for the color red, then all you see is red things. And I wonder whether, because sometimes we expect things to be red, that they just, then that's all you see. Mm. I think there is one layer of filter which says, and this may be controversial, one layer of filter which says, if you're looking for toxicity and you're looking for those examples, then you will see them a lot. So there is one part of me that says, okay, just make sure that you can also see the non-toxic things. Mm. Maybe look for the color blue, mm-hmm. In that analogy. And maybe you can see some blue things, and that might give you some balance. So that's the first thing. So look at it in a balanced way, I would say. Mm. The second thing is that there are lots of companies who offer flexible working, whatever that means to you. And I definitely am a believer that, you know, great ideas go to die in the boardroom and thrive in a coffee shop. So I'm flexible working all the way. And I am sure that there is, if you're brave enough, and you mentioned the word courage earlier, that looking outside, once you've got your filter right, looking outside is not a bad thing to do anyway if you feel that all you can see is too much red and toxicity. So I would have a look outside. You know, the world does never revolves around one company. It doesn't. And I think there must be opportunity out there. I think in that case, if toxicity is rife, for me that would be a very short journey to looking for another role. Mm. Now, having said that, should that be the case? The answer is no. But there are times when you have to make a decision which is right for you. And I think if health is suffering, then I wouldn't stay a moment longer.
Yes, I agree. I'm really glad I asked you that, because you've echoed what I would what I'd said, and it's just lovely to hear it from you as well. I guess you've probably, as part of your NLP studies, come across the science behind the filters of the reticular activating system. In other words, yeah. we you know, once we decide I'm going to buy a red Mini, we see red Minis on the car, on the road everywhere.
Yes, exactly that. And as humans, we are very good at both, mostly at looking for red, i.e. toxicity. And it's a massive reprogramming job to look for the miracle.
Absolutely. Jacqueline, you've given us some really sort of tempting things that I've got to ask you about. You said earlier in the interview that you had some, what did you say? Plenty of self-limiting beliefs. and you said that you've always kind of had a thing about self-worth and self-deserving.
Yeah. And I, yeah, definitely. So, you know, I think when I was younger, half Chinese, I mentioned earlier, and I went to school in a Catholic school. So everyone else was Irish, Italian or Polish, but all very white, and didn't have dark hair, dark long plaits, and certainly didn't have a surname that everyone made fun of. So it was, for me, there was a big survival world going on right through until, you know, I was 18. So that made me feel very, I think it gave me a big feeling of low self-worth. And there were certain points in which I thought, I'm going to engage, I'm going to excel. I was very into, you know, I've got 6 gold medals at Irish dancing, can you believe? But that's my Irish Catholic school upbringing. And it's hard to be that girl collecting a gold medal when you've got 2 long dark plaits and everyone else has got, you know, ginger ringlets. So, you know, fitting in and surviving was pretty tricky. And I think that's probably where that stemmed from. And, of course, everyone else seemed to have lovely whole families, and I didn't have that either. So it was, fitting in and my early upbringing was probably my biggest survival context, and that's where the low self-worth came from. Now, having said that, has it served me well? The answer to that is absolutely yes. I would not swap it, and I would always look back on my childhood and say, you know, I it was a good journey for me, and was it a school of hard knocks? I think it was. It was a lot of growing up very fast, very young. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I loved school. I loved every minute of it. And I had some challenges and struggles on the way, but they have served me well in my business world as well. I can definitely hold my own, and I'm probably at my best when I'm in a corner.
Do you think back when you're in a corner to, well, if I can survive that school with my long dark plaits, I can survive this?
Oh gosh, yeah, no, this is child's play at this point.
What do you do to look after yourself and to gently handle the self-worth issue? And I guess, Joe, you know, not just how you rationalize that in your mind, but what habits do you have that help you on a daily basis?
So I have some physical things I do. I'm up early. I'm a very early bird. I go to bed early too. By the way, I'm not Superwoman, so I do need my 7:30.
Tell us what time you go to bed and what time you get up.
Yeah, so I'm up at 5, but I would be in bed at 9:30.
Yeah.
And I love that. And in the morning, and sometimes it's up earlier because of flights and things, but my favorite time is with my husband. He's a teacher of yoga for special needs children, and he was in the tech industry, so he's built and sold 4 companies. And, you know, with him, I have that special moment in the morning where we meditate together, so we just find our balance, and that could be anything from 5 minutes to an hour, depending on my day. And after that, we do a little bit of yoga, or if I've been for a run, sometimes I run about 3 miles a day, 5 times a week, something like that. Then I'll do what we call stretching, but it's really yoga. And then I'm off out the door. He makes me some juices. We're a big juicing, green juicing family. And off I go to work. So that's, I feel very nourished and very looked after. And that's where I get my balance and my strength from. So that's my morning habit. And then my children are my regular little fixes. So I have a 23-year-old, 25-year-old, and now a 28-year-old who keep us busy at weekends, and we're very blessed to have them very close to us. So that's what we're like as a family.
Lovely. So your morning routines, you are up early, and then meditation, yoga, running. What about your evening routines?
Yeah, evening is all about communing, I suppose, eating with my husband and talking about the day. We also have 5 dogs, so they need a little bit of attention. And then we go to bed. So there isn't a whole lot going on there. And I don't do email in the middle of the night. I switch off, but I am on it first thing in the morning.
So when you say you're on email first thing in the morning, is that after your meditation and exercise, or would you do that first thing?
Yeah, I'm depending on the time of the quarter. So we have some imperative timing as we go through 3-month cycles. And as we get to the end of the quarter, sometimes things come in that are super urgent. So I might have a quick look. I try not to, because it means that I ruin the moment of meditation when I'm thinking about what's going to happen in the day, rather than my sleepiness as I come out of my night. So definitely the ideal scenario, which happens earlier in the quarter, is that I don't look at my phone.
Okay, yeah, that sounds sensible advice. Jacqueline, I have so many other questions that I want to ask you, but I'm very aware of time. I'd like to just ask you one last question. What does having it all mean to you?
Gosh, that's a fabulous question. I love it. Having it all means, to me, means having my family first. And that's, you know, I love, of course, my children and my husband and my dogs and all of the extended family that we have. But also it means having my team around me, and I hold my team very dear too. They are very loyal and very accomplished, and I learn from them all the time. So having it all means that, for me, from a people perspective first, is having great people around me. At work, it's people around me who can operate under pressure, and at home it's about having kids who are doing what they love, and having a husband who also does what he loves, and who is, you know, we are very supportive in our partnership. So to me, that's having it all. Having the roles that I have, president of Tech UK and Citrix, and the board roles that I have, to me, that's about, I mean, that's my playground. And I really enjoy what I do. I don't find it stressful. I feel that I can really get into my stride with all of those different roles. And juggling those means that I put quite a lot of pressure on my amazing assistant, Lorna. Mm-hmm. But she's you know, part of the family partnership too. So having it all means I can do it all with help from a team that is absolutely amazing, and that's both family and work. So, yeah, I'm in a great place.
Wow, what a wonderful answer. And you went straight back to the that core value of family, people.
Yeah, definitely my number one.
Well, mine too. Jacqueline, thank you so very much for being here today. Thank you for talking to me. Thank you for sharing and for putting your generosity here. I know that this interview is going to be so helpful to so many people. So really, hand on heart, thank you very, very much.
Thanks, Amanda. And I'm very grateful to you for giving me the opportunity and giving everybody the opportunity to share their lives, journeys and thoughts with other people too. So great that you could shine a light on that.
Thank you for listening to the Inspiring Women interviews. You can find the episode show notes, backlist episodes and full transcriptions of each interview at amandaalexander.com/podcasts. If you'd like to connect, you can tweet me at AA the Coach or find me on Facebook at Amanda Alexander Coach.